Thank you so much. And can you hear me okay?
Perfect.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me here. And although we can't be in Prague, it's lovely to be here virtually with everybody. So I'm going to talk about Tibet and telling Tibet's story. Last month, the Communication University of China in Beijing hosted an online forum on telling stories of Tibet. And Global Times tells us it was attended by experts from China, from Nepal, from Japan, from even the UK and Germany. And the intention was to develop creative new methods of conveying the CCP's 21st century narrative on Tibet. The party's emphasis on telling the story of Tibet well has been emphasized consistently in state media, with the assertion in 2018 that propaganda thought and culture work on Tibet are at a new historic starting point. Telling the Tibet story is such an anodyne, seemingly harmless phrase, and in no way it conveys the depth and the extent of China's systemic efforts to not only silence Tibetans, but to erase their truth, to erase their agency through rewiring their thinking and belief systems. The real agenda is encapsulated far better with a phrase from an official document that applies to both Tibetans and Uyghurs, and giving the party's stated aim as breaking lineage, breaking roots, breaking connections, and breaking origins. It reflects the ideologically driven preoccupation in Beijing, bearing little or no relation, of course, to the situation on the ground, that the two major ethnic minority regions of the PRC presented grave and present danger to China's overall security. From the patriotic education campaigns of the mid-1990s onwards, the CCP has accelerated efforts to change Tibetan minds. And this is inextricably linked to the imperative of changing ours too, as China uses various means of covering up information, subversion, and distortion of the conversation on Tibet globally. And this imperative was underlined by Xi Jinping at the 7th Tibet Work Forum in August, which dictates the policy cycle for the next 5 to 10 years. Reflecting Tibet's strategic and geopolitical importance to the Communist Party, Xi characterized Tibet as an impregnable fortress and emphasized a further constricting ideological agenda. It's probably worth mentioning here why Tibet is so important to China, as this informs its whole agenda. China's policies in Tibet emerge from the PRC's stressing, pressing strategic and economic imperatives, and these are its control over its borders, now prioritized still further in the deepening tensions with India, raising the productivity of the core industrial cities of Xi'an, Chongqing, and Chengdu at the foot of the plateau, the expansion of mining based on the rich resources of the Tibetan plateau, that includes uranium, lithium, gold, copper, and that's in order to fuel China's economic development. Finally, to address the progressive scarcity of water shortages in the north and northeast of China, with water sourced in Tibet. That one's very important, of course. This combination of factors renders Tibet vital to the future of China in Tibet. Xi Jinping's leadership has presided over intensified militarization, disproportionate securitization, and massive social engineering campaigns, notably the displacement and relocation of Tibetans, particularly nomads and herders. And the Chinese Communist Party makes its intentions of attempted control over Tibet's past, present, and future clear when it references even the concept, the phrase that's emerged in Chinese, the post-Dalai Lama era. So, underlining these imperatives, three top political leaders, Wang Yi, Wang Yang, and Hu Chunhua, visited the plateau in the summer, and that indicated the high-level engagement on the plateau at the time of the work forum, which was held on August 28th and 29th. The visit of Wang Yi to Tibet's border areas came just prior to his visit to Europe in August, where he bumped elbows with Macron and amplified China's disinformation efforts on the origins of coronavirus. And Wang Yi's visit to Tibet was in the context of ongoing tensions with India. He's the special representative in border talks with India. And he's upholding a mantra of Xi Jinping that the security and stability of the PRC is dependent upon the so-called security and stability of its peripheries, of its borders. And in Tibet, we've seen that China has accelerated construction of what it calls well-off border defense villages, in which it's part of the CCP's far-reaching agenda to create an advanced and impenetrable security barrier between Tibet and the outside world. That was something, again, that was emphasized in the 7th Work Forum. And CCP cadres are stationed in these new villages with the aim of countering infiltration by hostile forces. And that includes Tibetans loyal to the Dalai Lama, for example, and generally ensuring compliance with CCP objectives. So crucial to China's new telling of Tibet's story are two equally bland phrases concealing the glint of the knife: ethnic unity and Sinicization. And the Chinese author Zhang Shanlang wrote in his Cultural Revolution Labor Camp memoir, Grass Soup, that thought reform was equivalent to using a wooden knife to kill a man. He said, such a knife was aimed not at a man's throat, chest, or stomach. Instead, it attacked the invisible world around him, the invisible feelings that tied him to the world around him. A wooden knife could not enter a man's flesh, but it was plenty sharp enough to cut immaterial things. So the adoption of ethnic unity regulations in January are a legal articulation of long-held policy goals that seek to reduce ethnic differences, erase distinctive identities, and achieve a stable Han-centric society. Taken together with the aim of Sinicizing Tibetan Buddhism, a 5-year program that began last year, the regulations also reflect the culmination of Xi's policy focus to consolidate power in the party and to eliminate threats. And that includes existential ones, such as the Dalai Lama. It's the idea, the political idea of I live, you die. And this reflects a policy argument formed by a number of influential Chinese figures such as Huanggang and Ma Rong, and they're known as the architects of the CCP's position on so-called ethnic minorities aimed at enforced assimilation of Tibetan culture. And all of you at Synopsis have documented this trend very well, along with scholars including James Liebold, James Millwood, and others. So the stakes could not be higher for the survival of Tibetan Buddhist civilization, which has been highly influential itself globally as the 85-year-old 14th Dalai Lama ages. To fully understand this retelling of the story, we need to go back to 2008, when Beijing was preparing for a dazzling Olympics. And Tibetans then were acutely aware, of course, of the global spotlight on China, but much more deeply cognizant of another anniversary, the 10th of March 1959, the uprising, which led to the killing, torture, and imprisonment of thousands of Tibetans, and the escape into exile, of course, of their beloved leader, the Dalai Lama. So on March the 10th, 2008, a group of Drepung monks led a peaceful march to Lhasa, where they were surrounded by paramilitary police before being dispersed. It was one of hundreds of overwhelmingly peaceful protests happening across the plateau at that time and for months afterwards. And they involved Tibetans from every sector of society: nomads, monks, nuns, teachers, intellectuals, grandmothers, school children. The protests and the brutal crackdown that followed propelled Tibet to the top of the news agenda as Beijing prepared to host the Olympics. It was obviously a PR disaster for the CPC, and their first attempt to fix it dramatically backfired. They invited a group of Western Chinese correspondents to Lhasa a few weeks later with the aim of showing that the capital was back to normal after the rioting, smashing, looting, burning, as they described it. But instead, a group of Jokang monks confronted them and straight to camera told the journalists not to believe the lies that they were being told. It can be described as Tibet's first truthful press conference. So after March 2008, the Chinese government sought to ensure that nothing like this that challenges their international image in Tibet could happen again. And they engaged in a comprehensive cover-up of the torture, disappearances and killings that had happened on the plateau. They combined that with a propaganda offensive against the Dalai Lama. And on a global stage, they refused to answer legitimate questions from government and about the use of lethal force against unarmed protesters or the welfare of individual Tibetan detainees. In addition, the CCP framed the hundreds of protests that had occurred, although they were overwhelmingly peaceful, as one violent riot. And even now, March 2008 is still depicted by some international media with this convenient shorthand that accords with the official line. A year later, in 2009, after the deaths and disappearances of untold Tibetans, we still don't know exactly how many, a monk called Tape walked out of his monastery in eastern Tibet in Amdo and set himself on fire. Tape survived, and he later had to endure the cruelty of being depicted, terribly burnt, in a propaganda video made to show that the Dalai Lama was the evil influence. And his action was followed by more than 150 self-immolations inside Tibet and 10 by Tibetans in exile. And in a letter written in the 1960s to Martin Luther King, the Vietnamese Thich Nhat Hanh observed about the Vietnamese monks who were setting themselves on fire at that time. In a remark it could compare to the Tibetan monks, he said, "To burn oneself by fire is to prove that what one is saying is of the utmost importance. To say something while experiencing this kind of pain is to say it with utmost courage, frankness, determination, and sincerity. The importance is not to take one's life, but to burn. What he really aims at is the expression of his will and determination, and not death." Almost all of the Tibetans who set fire to themselves communicated a wish for the Dalai Lama to return home and for freedom. And although Chinese officials did seek to turn public opinion against them, their efforts were a complete failure. Thousands of Tibetans gathered to pray and pay their respects for those who self-immolated, and peaceful protests often followed too. It was a new political moment in Tibet, and it was a glaring counter to the claims of the CCP that they were improving Tibetan lives. The city of the gods, Lhasa, which is now remodeled into a hub of hyper-securitization and a glittering stage set for invited foreign diplomats, had been named as the as China's city with the happiest people for several years running. Aimed mostly at a domestic rather than an international audience, it had never seen such an empty claim. So before that time, before 2008 and 2009, Chinese officials had sought to project the notion that only a handful of Tibetans, mostly monks and nuns, caused unrest in Tibet entirely due to the Dalai Lama's influence. And now many of them realize that their efforts of persuasion, the mass campaigns of patriotic education in the 1990s and beyond, had completely failed to ensure how they defined stability or to deeply touch the inner lives of Tibetans. And so it was decided that political education had to reach a new stage with a deeper reach in the war against successionist sabotage. The Chinese government sought to replace the loyalty to the Dalai Lama in Tibetan hearts and minds with allegiance to the Communist Party state, and in doing so, to literally obliterate memory and to break the roots and connections at the heart of Tibetan Buddhist beliefs and civilization. And a party cadre who was interviewed at the time by a Tibetan friend said that China had realized that without completely controlling Tibetan thinking and what he described as the consciousness sphere, the mission of achieving the desired long-term stability, which ultimately means complete compliance with the CCP, would be impossible. So this position reflected also the CCP's broader anxieties over Tibet. Tibet is not only regarded as a core issue of Tibet's, of the PRC's territorial integrity, but also as a matter of national security. And there were further major shifts following the takeover of Chen Guangguo as TAR party secretary in 2011. Prior to the mass internment of the Uyghurs, and under the leadership of Chen Guangguo, now Xinjiang's party chief, and Marcus will be talking about him shortly, Tibet was used, of course, as a laboratory to implement oppressive new measures of surveillance, an iron grid system of securitization, and accelerated cultural assimilation. And these dystopian measures are shaping the Tibetan experience of reality. A Human Rights Watch report recently involved the reverse engineering of an app used for police surveillance, which many of you will have seen. And this report concluded that an examination of the list of research topics of the app, which applied to Xinjiang, suggests Chinese police are developing capabilities for the reality mining that go beyond existing forms of surveillance by studying how people interact, using data gathered by machines such as their mobile phones or checkpoints, an approach considered more accurate than existing subjective sources. The authorities seemingly hope to be able to understand in a more fine-grained way how people lead their lives, whom they talk to, and where they go and what they do. So the goal is apparently to identify patterns of and to predict the everyday life and resistance of its population and ultimately to engineer and control reality. But the CCP knows that the human element is crucial in combination with new technological capabilities. And among other measures, a new structure of monastic management was imposed, requiring monasteries to be run not primarily by committees of monks, but by party officials. And critically, the transfer of thousands of party cadres to Tibet to work at grassroots level began, human to human, in some cases, as in Uyghur areas, with party cadres literally embedded in Tibetan homes and learning in granular detail about their lives and motivations. So to transform everything, as the Tibetan writer Wosa puts it about the CCP's current efforts, you also have to study everything. And in this case, a story from a friend of mine who was imprisoned as a monk in the 1990s is very telling. He told me a story of a conversation he had with a prison official in Lhasa's notorious Drapchi jail. And this was in the late 1980s. And it was 2 years into his sentence. And he was summoned into the office of a senior Chinese prison official. And such invitations were generally greatly feared because they knew what would usually result. And my friend was frightened. But when he arrived, he was offered a cup of tea and a cigarette, an act that had never happened before. And he was invited to sit down and to talk for 2 hours. He said that this small act of kindness was so overwhelming that he completely dropped his guard. The official wanted to know various questions: why he had risked his life in protesting, did he regret it, did he still think that Tibetan independence was something worth fighting for, why was a Tibetan prepared to risk so much for shouting simply "Long live the Dalai Lama" in the street. My friend was honest, and he said that even if the Chinese killed us, this still wouldn't solve the Tibetan problem with China, because Tibetans and Chinese have a totally different culture. They still believe passionately that Tibet should be independent. He also told him that the patriotic education system in prison was ridiculous. They were given the answers to specific questions. They asked the questions and then had to recite the answers. The prison official laughed. Maybe he even agreed. They spoke for 2 hours, and it was an encounter between two very different ways of thinking. But my friend later realized that this was a real indication of the granular detail that the Chinese officials in charge sought to gather. And they knew that in order to do so, they had to communicate as one human being to another. At that time, the CCP did not have the facilities, the infrastructure, the technological means, the personnel required to literally change the thinking of people. Now they do. And we're witnessing, of course, a much deeper evolution of strategies of control, of conversion, from the bedrock of thought reform techniques, which were developed in the 1950s and 60s, and that are documented in Robert J. Lifton's classic text on that. In the 12 years since those courageous monks at the Jokhang looked journalists in the eyes and told them the Chinese government is not telling the truth about Tibet, China has intensified its efforts to silence Tibetans and to prevent any news from reaching the outside world. Tibetans have been locked in effectively, and more people have been locked out. Prior to 2008, thousands of Tibetans were coming into exile, often to see the Dalai Lama for the only time in their lives. But last year, only 18 were able to do so. Any communication at all is much more difficult. There's already plenty documentation of the difficulties in communicating on WeChat and even on sensitive issues such as the environment. Space has been completely contracted. So at the same time, information from outside is totally blocked, and parameters for thought are developed at a very early age, from kindergarten, literally changing the way in which young Tibetans ask questions and steering them into predetermined channels. And at the 7th Work Forum in August, Xi Jinping stressed that patriotism, the party's view of it, should be incorporated into the whole process of education, right from the beginning of schooling. So this new political direction is compounded by a much more entrenched regulatory framework and a comprehensive system of policing of monasteries and nunneries. In addition, the CCP seeks to cultivate the red gene, particularly among young people in rural areas, and membership is required to progress in every sphere of society, as it is elsewhere in China. And importantly, this system inspires the kind of fear that suppresses awkward questions, as well as seeking to stop Tibetans from thinking them in the first place. How am I doing for time? I still have a few points.
Kate,
okay.
If you can finish in 2 minutes, it will be great. We have another two speakers, so sorry for it.
Of course. Okay, so what I'll do is just make a few points about counter-influence, if I may. So thinking of Tibetans as transformers, as agents of change, as opposed to the victims of these measures. So firstly, just to mention, the Dalai Lama has reshaped his role on the global stage. Unusually for a religious leader, he's influential in the field of secular ethics. He's also engaged in a dialogue with modern scientists in fields of cosmology, quantum physics, which has also gained him new secular platforms. He has his influence reaches into China, impacting Chinese Buddhists and cultivating a deep respect for Tibetan Buddhism. Many Chinese now have Tibetan religious teachers and have been impacted also by his teachings. As China steps up its efforts to control the Dalai Lama's succession, the Dalai Lama has neatly undercut Beijing's intensified efforts by suggesting that the process of reincarnate lamas and choosing them may have had its day because the hierarchy is linked to a feudal system. So, and the Dalai Lama's comments really expose the absurdity of the imposition of legislation by the CCP to install and manage official reincarnations. Now, current circumstances also remind us that it was not only the iron grid of preemptive policing and total surveillance that was trialed in Tibet. Teachings by the Dalai Lama, the Karmapa, and other religious leaders, particularly during the current pandemic, underline that well before that, Tibetans themselves trialed solitude, lockdown, and techniques to survive this that they have endured for far longer, underpinned by the core of teachings that have shaped Tibetan civilization. And this has given rise to a remarkable resilience. And while the crackdown in Tibet has intensified in scope and tactics, an alternate narrative of cultural resilience is most certainly taking shape in Tibet as Tibetans themselves take increasingly bold steps to defend and protect the core values of their language, their cultural and religious identity. And Tibetan historian Tsering Shakya writes of a Tibetan term meaning smile in the face, fire in the belly. And this Tibetan word most often used to describe the concept of resistance means literally to oppose or to stand against the face. And the term conjures an image of a person turning away from what is confronting them and conveys a refusal to acknowledge that confrontation. So while China's state media is showing happily singing and dancing Tibetans and Uyghurs and showing Lhasa as the happiest city is aimed at showing this smile on the face, resistance can take many, many forms. And the fire in the belly is not always visible. And these acts of turning away or not giving face, implicit in the Tibetan term for resistance, are a refusal to recognize something that is not worth recognition, despite the demands of the all-powerful party state for demonstrations of submission and compliance. So I'll close there. Thank you.